Hi, I'm John. I'm walking down Milwaukee Avenue, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is wonderful to be here with you today for show number 979. What we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Now, I am, admittedly a little bummed out right now as our government moves to strip away funding for public broadcasting in this country. I know some folks locally who work for or have worked for NPR, and I'll tell you, they are professionals who care about telling important local stories that impact our community and region. So in that sense, I feel a connection to those brothers and sisters in sound. And this stripping away of funding has a significant impact on rural communities. The New York Times reported this week, quote, "The real pain will be felt by local stations in far-flung locations like Unalakleet, Alaska, and Pendleton, Oregon. Those broadcasters often rely disproportionately on federal grants for their operations because of a funding formula that takes into account the fact that they have fewer donors and programming sponsors." An internal report from 2011 obtained by the New York Times said that if Congress cut off funding for the public radio system, up to 18% of the roughly 1,000 member stations would close, with broadcasters in the Midwest, South, and the West affected the most. Nationwide, up to 30% of listeners would lose access to NPR programming. For PBS, local TV stations would also bear the brunt of the cuts, and popular programs like the PBS NewsHour and Nature might need to find money elsewhere, such as from donations or syndication, end quote. Okay, I'm not trying to be a downer on a Saturday morning, but I'm pulling for the public broadcasters here. They ask tough questions, they bring us solid reporting, and the science programming that they have is great. I was in South Bend earlier this week, and I watched a fascinating show on dinosaurs on PBS in the hotel. It was awesome. Also, don't forget about programming like Sesame Street and Elmo. Okay, well, maybe Elmo we'll come back to. He's had a tough week, so I'll leave him and his social media accounts out of this. But on this show today, we will get an update about an organization doing some wonderful work in Chicagoland by helping to eliminate the diaper gap. But like the public broadcasters in this country, they're looking for some new funding. And if you could tell your story of growing up, your story, what would that be? We hear from someone who just put out a book about growing up in a Chicago suburb. So stick around for these local conversations, won't you? Clarendon Hills is a lovely suburb west of Chicago, incorporated in 1924. So what was it like growing up there? Well, Roger Day Bain can answer that question. His new book is called Clarendon Hills Kid, and it offers reflections of growing up in the 1950s and 60s in that suburb with, as he says, a few facts thrown in. We could check out his website, rogerdaybain.com, B-A-I-N. Roger, welcome to Outside the Loop. It's nice to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike. It's my pleasure and an enjoyment.
Well, I enjoyed reading your work here because, look, Clarendon Hills, you know, I grew up in Elmwood Park, so not, you know, terribly far away. It was another western suburb, but I didn't have a lot of, sort of understanding history. I didn't know anyone from Clarendon Hills is what I'm trying to say. And your story of growing up in Clarendon Hills in this book, Clarendon Hills Kid, you tell the story of growing up there in the 50s and 60s. So, all right, first of all, what was it like? What was it like? Just give us a brief overview growing up in Clarendon Hills during this time.
It was utterly tranquil, for one thing. And, you know, from my distant perspective, looking back, it was just a montage of kids playing games, chasing butterflies, nonstop baseball, coming in for dinner, playing pom-pom, pull away and Red Rover and all that after dinner. But I think when I reflected on it, one of the main takeaways is that I was living in a place where I didn't have any fear. It was so tranquil that everyday life was just a joy. And I think that it was at a time before we've been violated by the onslaught of social media, digital media, and websites and 24-hour cable news and all that. And so I think that perhaps is part of the reason. But when I was growing up there, the suburbs were a newish phenomenon. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was moved there at age one, it was in 1949, and Chicago was the eighth largest city in the world. And today it's 180th. That's a side fact. But the suburbs were new. Everybody who was there in Clarendon Hills, there weren't great wealth distinctions. Both sides of the track seemed serene and safe. And the railroad ran right through Clarendon Hills. That was its point of being. It was a milk stop, I guess. You know, I found out all sorts of things about Clarendon Hills. Of course, growing up, I didn't know.
Sure.
And I didn't mean to write a history, and certainly this book is not a history. It's more of a reflection and a, you know, social history and kind of a cultural analysis. Because when I left Clarendon Hills, I thought it was probably one of the most boring places on earth.
Yeah. Well, you know, in terms of this book and what you're saying here, it doesn't read like a history book. It reads kind of like a collection of short vignettes. And
yes,
it's your experience, obviously, growing up there. So from your perspective, so a collection of these short stories. In fact, you were talking about not having any fear. One of those stories is entitled No Fear. And I think that's kind of cool because today we're so, like you were talking about, just inundated with social media, with digital this, tracking that. You know, just the idea of getting out as a kid, riding your bike and telling your parents, you know what, I'll be home at dinner. Otherwise, I'll just be in the neighborhood, getting into things, finding friends. I love that. So why did you want to tell these stories? What was the motivation in your brain that said, you know what, growing up here, having that kind of freedom, that kind of youth, I want to tell these stories? Why did you want to do that?
I had written a book, Hardly Working, and I thought, well, this can't be the only book I write. And I had started to write essays, or actually I just jotted down ideas. Well, I didn't jot because I was using computer. No more jotting.
No more jotting. Not allowed.
No. Although when I used to write, it was a yellow legal pad on my lap when I started writing in the late 1970s. But I just thought I would like to revisit my childhood without making it all about nostalgia.
Right.
You know, doing a book like this, it would be easy to veer into endless nostalgia. Oh, remember this and that. And it's inescapable that those things are in there, about like when we got our first electric can opener and you know, incidents like that, or when I first saw Elvis on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And it's impossible not to have that in there. But I thought, well, first of all, no one had ever done an analysis of Clarendon Hills. Their Historical Society, which is a wonderful organization, recently put out a history, you know, a picture history of Clarendon Hills with, you know, with a lot of pros as well. But this was more like my point of view. I wasn't trying to make it from everybody's point of view.
Sure.
But I think if you look at a city like Chicago, there have been plenty of books about Chicago. And because Chicago's looked upon as an important city, an important place. And of course, there's so many people who live there, you have a greater opportunity to find a writer who's going to write about Chicago. But no one had done anything about Clarendon Hills. And so I meant for this to be a long essay, and I wasn't even going to divide it up into chapters. But then as it got to be about 10,000 words, and I kept on going and going and going, I thought, well, it can't just be one long essay without any breaks. And so I had to go back and sort of retrofit some of the subject material into logical little chapters. And yes, you can read any of these out of order.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like that about the book, you know, and the one thing I read this is on page 158, a word about newspapers. And really, this is where I think this book, kind of what you're talking about here, it's all connected, because this book is kind of like a social history, maybe, for sure, oral history, I think, definitely. But you say here, you say in the book, quote, newspapers provided a shared civics lesson absent in current culture. When was the last time you saw a 14-year-old kid reading one? Yes, there are digital versions of major papers today, but the newsprint version might lay around the house and maybe a headline would catch your eye and a new reader was born. Reading the newspaper was a step toward adulthood. The disappearance of local newspapers in daily American life is an ongoing, irreplaceable loss to society, but that's another story, end quote. When I was a teenager, I loved, before school, to pick up the newspaper. I would read that thing. Even if I didn't understand some of what I was reading, I kind of knew what was going on, and I miss that. I don't think we do that anymore. But boy, that right there, I think that jumped out at me from your book. That's who we are, who we were, maybe, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and newspapers was a big deal because my dad had originally worked for the Chicago Daily News, and so, you know, he would come home with the red streak under his arm because the Daily News put out at least two editions, the blue streak in the morning and the red streak in the afternoon. And at a young age, he took me to his office in Chicago, and I was just dumbfounded. It was my first time in the city. I must have been 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And so newspapers were in our family blood, but they were everywhere. Everybody read the newspaper, and the fact, because of the medium itself, a newspaper that would sit here or there in the house, it is impossible to, you know, any kid would have an opportunity to just, oh, what does that headline say? And you don't have that same opportunity today, that's for sure.
I totally agree with you, and I really enjoyed the book. I also want to talk about here, Roger, Hardly Working. This was your book that came out in 2023. This is such a cool book, too. You know, we've been talking about Clarendon Hills Kid, but Hardly Working, can't sleep on Hardly Working. I really like checking this out. So this is kind of like, again, a little bit of your story, but this is focused on your working life, your career. Tell us why you wanted to tell the story of your career.
Oh, my spotty career. Don't try this at home.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think when I finally found what it is I like to do, I mean, as a young kid, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. And that was sort of the same in college. After I left college, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. But I think it was around 1997. I had kids who were teenagers, and I thought, well, I wanted to impart some wisdom to them about their father. I want to let them know everything that I've done to have as a job or to make money, no matter how short or brief it was, you know, one day in a sawmill in Arizona, or, you know, being a caddy when I was age 12. I just wanted them to get a flavor for the opportunities that life holds. And so Artly Working is really more of an autobiography filtered through the lens of work, because it isn't a true autobiography. Every chapter in it is about a different job I had, or a different thing that I was pursuing. But I outline everything, you know, my summer jobs, my part-time jobs, and my between jobs escapades, of which there were many.
Yeah. You know, you are, and this comes through in the book, you're a very creative guy. You are also a musician. You've done a lot of work in media. In 1979, you wrote a song about Mr. Cub, Ernie Banks, called Thanks, Mr. Banks. And this little connection here with WGN Radio, the great Roy Leonard, you sent the song to Roy.
Yeah.
He liked it. He played it. And you got to meet Ernie Banks, and you tried to get more publicity through the radio station, and they pretty much said, hey, we're a talk station, kid.
Right, right. Yeah. I don't know. You know, I was, I'd been writing songs for a number of years in 1979, and it just came to me, hey, as a subject matter, a lot of my songs are subject oriented. And I thought, well, he was my hero growing up. And the reason we liked Ernie Banks is because he seemed to enjoy baseball as much as me and all my cronies did, my little league friends, the neighborhood kids. And so I wrote it, and I went to a studio in Topeka, Kansas, the hotbed of recording music. And laid it down and sent it to Roy Leonard. And yeah, he liked it, and he played it. And I thought, oh man, this is going to be something.
There was one player who cut above the rest. It's safe to say he was Chicago's best. He was my hero, and he still is today. And since I was a kid, I have been meaning to say, thanks, thanks.
But it's still a good record. It holds up. It's just that being an independent out of nowhere with no record label person in 1979, it was impossible. Apparently, the song got on Drive Time for a couple weeks in Rockford.
There you go.
So, but it was a great experience. And going to GN on opening day of 1979, and Ron Santo and Ernie Banks were Roy's guests, and I was in the next control booth watching it all. And Roy puts on the record, and Ernie jumps up and starts dancing. Ernie thought it was disco, which it isn't. It isn't remotely disco.
No.
Anyway, it was a fun experience.
Yeah, it sounds that way. I mean, you've also, I thought this was kind of cool. In the mid 1980s, you almost became a TV star at NBC5 Chicago. But it didn't work out. You got down to like the final, I guess the final group, but they didn't pick you. Was it a kids show you were thinking about doing?
Well, with the kids show, yes, we produced a pilot, a full blown pilot, that is probably one of the quirkiest, zaniest things that's ever been on Chicago television. And I had no desire to be a kids show host. I think the way it came about is I had been in cable TV in Lawrence, Kansas. It was like my own video laboratory. I could do whatever I wanted with the old 3/4 inch clunky video tape. And I did a lot of quirky little things, you know, skits and bits and nonsense and absurdist surreal bits and all that. And I had sent a tape to the guy who was the program director at NBC5 at the time, and he had me come in. He loved him. And so he started saying, well, here, we got this late night show. Maybe you could host this. It was going to be Republic serials with things like The Moon Menace. And I would be the quirky host. And, you know, so we did that. And then they couldn't get the rights to the serial, so we didn't do that. And then I was going to be a morning talk show host. And I auditioned for that, and I got the part, and we did a pilot. And then the next day, and this was going to be a show like a radio show on TV. And this was back in 85. Mm. I mean, no one was doing anything like that. Like for the weather, I was just going to go to the top of Merchandise Mart and look out the window and describe the clouds.
Yeah.
You know, and things like that. And so anyway, they got a new GM. He canned all local production for 6 months or something like that as he was trying to put his stamp on the station. So that didn't work out. And then we had this kid show, a couple of wise guys, and it was crazy. And I ditched work in order to tape the show because at the time I was working for, I think, Centel Cable Television. And so I was moonlighting doing creative things, and I just left work, went to the studio, and we taped over 3 days, but it's still available. You can see it. I think if you look for a couple of wise guys on one of my many YouTube channels, but it's something that I'll tell you, the neighborhood kids where I live all grew up.
Well, you know, I think that this book, Hardly Working, is cool because, you know, today we're talking about trying to, you know, get jobs, and there's some industries have seen a reduction in jobs, and people, young people, don't know what they want to do. And I think by reading this book, it's really clear that what you want to be in life, it's not linear. Right. It's not a straight line. You can take some left turns. In fact, like what you're talking about, you've taken many left turns and you've documented that.
I was going in circles with left turns. I got dizzy.
Right. Right. Well, but that's OK. Right. Like explore, do things, you know, drive a cab, be a cook before you settle down and do something that you find that you love. That's what I got from this book.
Yes. And it actually, I had no career path. I had a degree in journalism from the University of Kansas, but I had really no intention of doing anything with that. The world, you just don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. You don't know what this afternoon's going to bring. Although in my case, I'm going to the dentist to have a filling replaced. But anyway... when I wrote the book, my real hope was that younger, curious readers would read it so that they could maybe once were just departing high school or college, they could get a feel, even though it's a different era, for the way you can bounce around and have a good time and learn about the world. And if you do enough stuff, a career will come into focus. And that's sort of what I did.
That's right. The book is called Hardly Working, How I Found a Career and Kept My Soul. And the latest book is Clarendon Hills Kid, both authored by Roger Day Bain. Check out the website, rogerdaybain.com. That's Bain spelled B-A-I-N, rogerdaybain.com. Roger, it is so great to talk to you, and I really enjoyed these books, and I think everyone will enjoy these books. We can go onto your website. There are links to get these books there. That's, I think, the quickest way to do that, to get those books in the digital age that we live in, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Share Our Spare is a Chicago-based nonprofit that partners with social service agencies across Chicagoland to provide children from birth to age 5 the essentials they need for healthy development, such as diapers, baby care items, clothing, books, and other resources. Since 2021, this organization has been instrumental in providing 17 million diapers to Chicago area families in need due to a partnership with the Greater Chicago Food Depository. That partnership has ended, and Share Our Spare is exploring new funding opportunities. Alex Goodfellow is the executive director of Share Our Spare, and she is with us today. Alex, nice to talk to you again. Welcome back to the show.
You too. Thanks for having me. It's great to be able to chat again.
Yes. Yeah, so we'll talk about what's going on with this funding stuff here, but really, you know, you and I chatted last year, and let's just refresh everyone's memory about what Share Our Spare is all about, because this was founded in 2011. And, you know, when you're the parent of young kids, there's a lot of stuff that you need. And,
yes,
you know, kids grow so fast, especially from birth to age 5, and they grow out of things. And then all of a sudden you don't need certain things. So the idea here behind your organization is that instead of throwing out resources for these young kids that we might not need anymore, we can kind of pass them along, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I swear every time I turn around, my kids, I'm like, didn't I just buy you new shoes? How are your feet always growing? Like, yep. What the heck? But that's what they do, right? They're kids. So, yes, we were founded and created under this belief that we have the resources within our community to ensure that every child has what they need, and have just made it our job to work on recirculating those goods in our community. And, you know, I think as I grew up, I got hand-me-downs from my siblings, right? So
right.
It's kind of the same idea, but in a community model.
Yeah, I like that idea of that community hand-me-down model. I mean, I think that's something that young parents of young kids can really benefit from. And really, when you look at the statistics here, this is amazing. And I feel like we might not know this, but it's important to keep this in mind. Nearly 1 in 2 families struggling to afford diapers these days because diaper costs have increased about 48%. Diapers cost a lot of money, don't they?
They do. And kids need so many of them, right? You know, we really talk about the importance of an adequate supply of diapers, because when a kid stays in diapers for too long, they can get urinary tract infections, obviously diaper rash and other dermatitis issues. And so it's really important for us that kids are able to stay, you know, dry and clean and healthy, and having that adequate supply is really important. And what we know is what you said, that cost has really gone through the roof, as have so many costs, right? We can talk about eggs is a favorite and food. But I think that diapers are often left out of that conversation because it's as basic and as much of a necessity as food, but it's for a smaller population of us. And once your kids get past that, you don't think about it as much anymore. But diapers have gotten extremely expensive and the need has grown. When we last talked, actually, I think the need was 1 in 3 families. And a new study shows that now it's nearly 1 in 2 families have an unmet diaper need. So that cost going up so much, and obviously just general cost of living going up so much, families are really making a lot of hard choices between getting adequate supply of diapers and adequate amount of food on the table. And so we're really trying to help fill that gap.
Yeah, and this is an amazing statistic. Families are spending an average of $80 to $100 a month on diapers.
Yes.
And, you know, look, we'll talk about some of the funding stuff in a second here, but I have to ask you about what's going on at the federal level here. And I feel like I've been asking that question of a lot of people I'm talking to. Like, what's going on here? But look, there are some cuts to Medicaid that are on the horizon here and food stamps. And so in terms of how this impacts what you do, I feel like it really makes the mission of Share Our Spare in providing some resources for these families with young children even more valuable. But really, what's happening at the federal level, is this impacting you?
Absolutely. You know, we work with, as we talked about our community model, we do not work directly with families. We work with other nonprofits throughout Chicagoland that are directly servicing families with, childcare, homeless services, violence prevention services, employment services. So my favorite part of what we do is the diversity of the work our partners do. We have an incredible group of partners that are out there every day, really working directly with families. So I have to give them that shout out. I have to give them that highlight. A lot of them are going to feel those effects really heavily, especially with, changes that have been made to Head Start. We work with a lot of folks doing Head Start, with Medicaid and with food stamps. And so we're going to feel it a little more indirectly, right? We don't get federal funding directly, but mm-hmm. our partners do, and our families are going to be losing so many benefits that we're going to feel the squeeze in that way. And to your point, there's so much chaos. There's so much going on. There's so much being cut. And for us, that also makes things harder and being able to grow and find funding, right? Because there's that much more need for that many more things, that many more basic essentials and basic care services. And so while it's not direct, it's kind of like the whole system has been squeezed.
Yeah. And I think that ripple effect is something that maybe we don't hear about because we're so focused on the impact, the direct impact on some of these nonprofits. And I think rightfully so. They're very important. And sure. You know, like what you're talking about with Share Our Spare, you're partnering with 79 social service agencies across the region. So a lot of nonprofits that you work with who are being squeezed here. So that kind of takes us into what's happening directly with Share Our Spare is this relationship that you had with the Greater Chicago Food Depository. This was specifically with that diaper program. So addressing that diaper gap, as you call it. So that now that partnership has ended. So tell us where you're at and what's happening here with Share Our Spare.
Yeah, the partnership we had with the Food Depository is amazing. It's incredible. You know, they did a beautiful job stepping up during COVID, and as part of their effort of stepping up to support the community more, created this COVID, this was a COVID response, this diaper program. And they knew that as much as families needed food, that they were hearing a lot of need for diapers. So we worked together to provide diapers to 50 of their pantry sites, mostly across the south and west sides, but as far north as, Evanston. So quite a reach. Mm-hmm. And simply talking about this squeeze again, here's a perfect example of indirect. Indirect impact is the Food Depository has been, really squeezed with this. They've lost a huge chunk of funding. SNAP is really, really impacting them, especially because families have that much more need. So they have that much more of a gap to fill. I know we've talked about this a lot, or we're hearing this a lot, but social services are a stopgap, right? We know that Share Our Spare is a stopgap because there's no government support. There's no large infrastructure or system support happening. That's really what private philanthropy and nonprofits are stopgaps, right? We're there in the community making sure families have what they need immediately in emergency situations. Mm-hmm. Should something happen. Obviously, folks rely upon food banks and diaper banks and things like that, but we don't, our goal and our ability is never going to meet all of the need. And we know that, but we're part of a group, we're part of a systems change. And so it's all ripple. That's why we really feel the squeeze from losing government support, because that's the social, the safety net. And when you lose that social safety net at the government level, nonprofits really have to think about how that impacts us and what we can do with the little that we have. A food bank is never going to meet food insecurity needs. A diaper bank is never going to meet diaper insecurity needs. And this whole piece is like, now we really have to think about where we put our resources and how we use them. And right now we know food is really important. And so diapers are too, but as the food depository, very clear that that's, you know, their main mission and where they have to focus.
Sure.
So yeah, it's, we all hate it. The food depository hates it. We hate it. But it's just a necessity. And so now we believe that the need is still, we know, not just believe, we know that the need is still really there in the community. We believe that we need to do something about it. And so that's why we don't want to just say, okay, program's ended. We really want to go out there and find some other opportunities where we can still have community access to diapers. When now that this has ended, there is nowhere in Chicago that a family can go for, like, I keep saying it's public access, right? Where they can go and get diapers in an emergency situation or at all, really.
I mean, when you put it like that, wow. When you think about the folks that relied on this and 17 million diapers since 2021, yeah. That is just amazing. So where you're at now, you're just exploring other possible funding opportunities. Are you looking to partner with anyone really that will help you out here? Is that kind of where you're at now?
Yes, that's our goal. You know, we have been talking to some of the pantries that we worked with and some other community hubs, community centers, community models, to be distribution sites. So we still have a model. We just need the dollars to make that happen. So that's our hope. And part of this conversation is to spread the word and see if we can let people know that that's what we're trying to do.
Right. So we can all go to the website, shareourspare.org. Shareourspare.org. Lots of really important information on that website, and we can get more in-depth information on what it is that your organization's all about. But you're looking for folks to partner with because even though the pandemic might be over, the need for diapers is still there, the need for resources for some of these families that are ultimately going to get squeezed, because if you're going to this diaper bank, maybe you're also on other government assistance. And so, you know, like we've been talking about this whole conversation, it's all connected. And I think that we need to think like that. You know, you might be doing okay, but it's kind of the responsibility, maybe the moral responsibility, the civic responsibility to help each other out. And that's kind of what Share Our Spare is all about.
That's what we believe. You know, it's kind of that whole piece where that we believe that all of the children in our community are our children, and that our future rides on them, right? And if we're not supporting them for a strong start and we're not ensuring that they have what they need at this point, how can, you know, when I'm old and retire, rely upon them to take care of us? That's our goal, right?
Yep. It's all connected. And again, we could check out the website, shareourspare.org. Really great work that this organization based in Chicago here is doing across the region. Alex, thank you so much. Alex Goodfellow, the executive director of Share Our Spare. Good luck going forward here. I've got faith. I mean, you're doing such great work. I think something's going to pop for you. And really, let's be in touch.
I hope. Thank you again for your time and helping us spread the word. And I agree. I think we're going to get it figured out.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 979 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. You are the best. Have a wonderful week. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.